podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Martin Lee, and this is the Autosport Podcast. With the final car unveiled last night with Alpine, Formula One's launch season 2023 is officially over. Next up, Bahrain testing next weekend. Joining me to analyse all 10 cars is Luke Smith. Good morning, how are you?
Good morning, Martin. Yeah, I'm doing well. It was a bit of a late night with Alpine, I won't lie to you. It was quite fun for them to hold it at Printworks. I used to live in East London as well, so it's quite nice to sort of, be back in that part of the world, sort of. It was cool. A really, really good event. Zinedine Zidane turned up. Like, that's pretty damn cool. And it was just really nice for them to, put on a good show and complete launch season, as you say. Now we know what all 10 cars, at least the liveries they're going to be running, maybe not exactly what every single car is quite going to look like, but we're getting ready for Bahrain now. It's, next week? I fly there on Tuesday, so it's, very, very soon. I can't wait.
Now, before we get going, last day for you at Autosport. You're setting up a new venture, but it's not fully baked. It's still in the oven. So you can't exactly say what that thing is that you're going to do. But I think it's fair to say we won't be strangers because you've just revealed you will be going to Bahrain. You joined Autosport around the time Jess McFadden joined as well. It was all around that kind of COVID and lockdown times. Can you remind me of the timeline?
Yeah, it was February 2020, so literally just before the pandemic really struck big time in the March. And I'd grown up reading Autosport and aspiring one day to work for the magazine, work for the company. And towards the end of 2019, we started having some conversations and things moved along. And February 2020, I had got the job and started. I remember going into the office and meeting all the people. And I remember through pre-season testing, we were getting sort of in the rhythm of me doing stories and stuff like that. And one of our colleagues said, I think we're maybe overblowing this COVID thing a little bit, sort of reporting about drivers getting stuck in training camps and stuff like that. And then, my first race, which wasn't a race that I did for Autosport, was the 2020 Australian Grand Prix. We were there for, I was there grand total of, I think, 46 hours or something, because I went back to New Zealand afterwards and then got one of the final flights home. So it was a funny old period, that, but it was that was 3 years ago now, just over. So it's been a absolutely remarkable 3 years, I must say, and I'm just so enormously grateful to everyone at Autosport for everything they've done, to everyone who's read, worked, tweeted, whatever. Like, I'm just so grateful, and it's been biggest privilege of my career to work with all of you guys and to represent such an iconic brand. There is nothing like it in motorsport media, and to have been part of that has been just an absolute honor. So I'm just so grateful to everybody.
What was the beat that we had you on then? Because obviously we got loads of people on the F1 team and everyone does a slightly different job. What have you been focused on for the last 3 years?
So my primary job has been news. It's been the F1 reporter role, which is all about getting the news, writing the news. So I hate to think how many articles I've written for Autosport in the past 3 years. Like, I'm gonna say it's probably into four figures. Like, it's been a huge amount of work, but I've loved it. That was the main beat. And over that time, it's been a lot of like doing podcasts with yourself, been doing videos, we've been doing lots of stuff on social. I've dabbled in long form features as well, and it's kind of just been lovely to be part of an organization where you can do all of that. Basically, you've got the full array of basically mediums to talk to fans and to interact with them. So but the main beat was news, and it's been cool. Like, it's been such a fascinating period of F1 to cover. Sport's in better shape than ever, and it's been really, really cool to be following that.
Where's my book? Hold on. I have it here. The Story of Porsche, a tribute to the legendary manufacturer. Luke has even had time in all of that to write a brilliant book. If you love the story of Porsche and the history of that brand, just any kind of there's in the same series, there's Ferrari and Harley and Mini and stuff, all these amazing brands that have wonderful kind of people going through and stories and all of these things. And so and they're ending up in a electric future for so many of them. So there, and you can even go on Amazon. And so in between all of that, Luke's managed to publish a book, which is, of course you had time to do that. So go and check that out on Amazon if, like me, you want to buy a copy. Well, obviously, we're really sad that you're not going to be doing these shows, but because we know what you're going on to, it's so brilliant. So we're all really excited to see you start that. I shall not say any more about where you're going. But it's not to go join Matt and Tommy, which is what everyone thought when Jess left to go to
Sky
Sports.
Yeah, it's funny that timing, wasn't it?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Like, oh, she's going to go rejoin the boys from WTF1. It's like, no, she's going to Sky Sports F1, which is where Jess is, if anyone had missed that piece of news. Anyway, you can follow Luke on his socials, and I'm sure he'll announce where he's off to soon. Let's get into the topic of today's podcast. So we're going to analyse all 10 cars, not so much the launches, because the launches, but in terms of the cars, and just have a look through what we ended up talking about. So we'll start off, we're going to in chronological order, but we may not dwell on too many of them. We started off with Haas. We were all desperate to talk about Formula One again this year, so it got a lot of coverage because it was first. Haas said they'll have a stronger upgrade push in 2023. Our colleague Matt Summerfield wrote about the detail changes that should stand out after it had a shakedown run at Silverstone. It ran for the first time, and so we got to see it. There was sort of a couple of days where lots of stuff happened all at once, and they were putting on Hulkenberg selfies of him at the factory, and we got to see more. But apart from that, it began as a livery launch. We got to find out more as the car went on. How do you feel about Haas's start to the season?
Yeah, it's been encouraging, I think. I think that with Haas, like, every year they kind of, it's a roller coaster. Like, every season's a bit different for them. There's always something that seems to happen. But I think it feels like they're going into this year in the strongest shape they've been for some time. They've got two very experienced drivers in Kevin Magnussen and Nico Hülkenberg. Hülkenberg coming in to replace Mick Schumacher. He's not been in F1 for 4 years, but he's got that experience. He knows what he's doing. He's a very safe pair of hands. So I think together that's what Haas needs. They've got a big new title sponsor in MoneyGram. That's, again, a big boost to financial stability. They announced Chipotle, the Mexican burrito and taco brand, as a, I don't know if that's the right way to word it, but it's that kind of stuff that they serve. But it's very, very tasty. And that's a new partner for Haas as well now. So clearly there is sort of a bit of momentum building with the team there. So that's really, really good. They've done a first shakedown at Silverstone. And I think for them, ultimately, this year is just about trying to make a bit of another step forward. Last year was such a weird roller coaster, from K-Mag finishing fifth in Bahrain to them struggling to get out of Q1 at races to then getting pole position in Brazil, and it was really sort of really up and down. And I think what they want is just a bit of consistency this year to even out those slopes, make sure they have a bit more of an even keel to the season. But I think for Haas, with them, it's always a bit strange and sort of odd to know where exactly they're going to be. I think really they've just got to look at building on last year. If they can take another step towards that sort of top of midfield, I think they'll be in good shape. But I think the changes they've made, with all respect to Mick Schumacher, I think it's been a decision that will help them in the long run. And I think that's what they're looking at. It's the long-term future. It's for the budget caps to really kick in, even out the playing field, and for them to be in even better shape.
Last night, I saw a new trailer drop for Netflix Drive to Survive. I think that's the 24th. I didn't make a note of it. So
it is. Yeah. I've actually watched the first episode. It's very, very good.
Oh, you've seen it? Amazing. Yeah. And in the new trailer last night, they have got a clip of Gunther and he is swearing, so you'll be happy, fans of sweary Gunther. Let's talk about Red Bull next, because then came Red Bull livery launch. The actual launch itself was a lot about the Ford partnership as well. Christian Horner said that they face a significant handicap with the F1 testing aero restrictions. Our colleague Matt Q wrote a plus piece about what recent F1 history reveals about the chances of Red Bull being caught in 2023. You know, once you're ahead, it's so hard to catch up for the others. Red Bull, Ford will not get a new new F1 engine supplier status when the Ford logo arrives in 2026. And Red Bull revealed afterwards that a new Honda deal was too complicated. That was the phrase. Despite talks, Sergio Perez said that he pushed for a certain direction on the car. Well, I'm sure he did, but let's not pretend that team doesn't have one number one. So what did you make of Red Bull's car?
Well, we've not seen it yet. It was the show car that they put in the new livery, and I think that's something that we'll get onto with the other launches, who did show us the actual car itself. So, it was a very impressive launch that Red Bull did in New York, and obviously the Ford partnership being announced and everything. Like, that was a big, big statement for them to make, I think, and to do it in New York, again, it points to the mass American growth there is at the moment. But again, we've not, and it's what Red Bull do every year. That's the thing. They never go, here's the actual car. It's always a show car of some sort in an updated livery. And that's well within their rights. They want to keep their cards close to their chest, and that's fine. We won't know anything really about that car until it hits the track on the first day of pre-season testing. But I think that for Red Bull, yeah, as you say, once you get out front, it is so hard for other teams to catch up. The aero testing restriction is going to bite at some point this year. That's a guarantee. And I think that you're looking at Ferrari and Mercedes to say, can they capitalise? But you've also got to bear in mind that Red Bull towards the end of last year did a lot of work that they said, no, let's just wait for the 23 car before we introduce that. So I think there was still a bit in hand really that they can put on this car. So yeah, I mean, they've got a target on their back. That's what comes with being the reigning champions. It's going to be hard to beat them this year. Max Verstappen remains at the absolute top of his game. And yeah, I'm just really interested in what that car looks like when we actually get to see it, because so far it's we don't know for sure. But I think weight saving, that's going to be a big story with them, as with every team. It was a big issue for Red Bull in the early part of last year. If they can get to that weight limit this year, they're going to be in really, really good shape.
Our colleague Alex Kalinorkis, our Grand Prix editor, thinks that the aero restrictions won't even properly bite until the 24 car. What's your thoughts on when they'll start to be impacted by those restrictions because of the cost cap overrun?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's fair. I think it will be that they're obviously going to be more limited in terms of what development they can do on the 23, because it was a 12-month penalty this came in for, starting as of, what, October last year. So it's until October 23 that's in place. So obviously that does cover a lot of the initial development for the 2024 car. And it is really just about how you use it. Basically, you've got a limited number of wind tunnel runs. You've got to be smart with what you do and don't be wasteful or anything like that. And I think it's definitely an impact. But talking to people from various teams, a lot of them say, nah, actually, it's not going to have a completely massive effect on the team, as I think Christian Horner maybe made it sound like it was actually going to be. So it's a funny one. But yeah, I'd be inclined to agree with Alex. I think that it'll be the 24 car where we really see like how much has it actually hurt them, and whether they're able to spool things back up in time to get that okay. But yeah, I think for now you'd still look at them as being favourites for the season to come.
Last year, of course, Mercedes even duped us at the first test. This year there's one pre-season test. So can you explain, well, even predict what you think we might see? Because, you know, we didn't even see the zero side pods concept until the second test with Mercedes, but we're talking about Red Bull. But like I say, one test in Bahrain before we go racing. So how much do you think will be revealed at testing?
I think that teams don't really have any time to waste. That's the difference this time around. Like last year, as you said, there was that first test in Barcelona where a lot of teams maybe just did an initial spec, came to Bahrain, put a load of upgrades on the car, made a lot of changes, the most notable being Mercedes. But this year, they've got one test of 3 days, and then they've only got, what, a 4 or 5 day turnaround until first practice for the Bahrain Grand Prix. So it's a very short window, and they've got a lot that they need to get into that time. So really, there's not really any time to waste. I don't think you can be affording to play chicken basically and say, oh no, we're going to wait until we put something on. I know a lot of teams are planning to bring upgrades compared to what they've run in Shakedown. Alpine, they've got a first race upgrade ready to go, which is a really good statement for them to make. But yeah, I think that if you're Red Bull, yeah, there's not going to be any time to waste. So they've done a shakedown with the car, so they'll have an initial reading of it. But when you get to testing, you can't be messing around saying like, oh no, we're going to wait. Like, you've just got to go all in, get ready, and get really primed for that opening race.
And so what is in terms of testing and turnaround? So obviously, you know, Bahrain is, or the testing's next weekend, then Bahrain's quickly followed by Saudi, and then Australia, and then Azerbaijan, and then Miami. So in terms of what we call the flyaway races, I'm down in Poole, which is a port. And so occasionally I'll see two or three of the big, shiny, gorgeous Formula One trucks, because they'll be getting on a, you know, a ferry to go somewhere. Which, if you're testing in Barcelona and you come across a problem, then I guess it's a reasonable solution to get those in the, you know, the CAD software overnight, get some parts made. You can either a private plane to a European test track, or you can drive it down, I suppose. But if any of the teams turn up in Bahrain next week and they've got significant issues, will they be able to get a fix in place before the first race?
the difference is that this year the cars, because it's an evolution on the regulations, not a revolution as it was in 22, I think it's quite unlikely that any of the teams will be in such a big sort of hole like that. But yeah, it is very true. It is, and it's one of the factors a couple of years back when we were debating about should we keep testing in Barcelona or should we just stick to Bahrain. Ultimately, Bahrain, yeah, you've got stable running conditions. You know it's going to be hot and sunny, which is good. But it is a thing of if something goes wrong, a flight is 5.5 hours back to the UK as opposed to doing an overnighter in a sprint van or something to get it down to Barcelona, or just a couple of hours on a flight. So it's definitely something for them to bear in mind. It's definitely an extra challenge, but I think all of the teams by now they know this is how it works. Like, I think they're all in good enough shape that it shouldn't be too much of an issue.
Next, we talk about Williams, and it's an evolution, despite key differences, they say, of the existing Formula One car, exactly like you just said. They said you wrote a piece about the loss of Latifi's F1 sponsorship not being as big as some suggested. James Vowles is the incoming boss of Williams, and he has a big job ahead of him to turn around. Is a storied team and plenty of people that have been there a very long time and will be used to doing things a certain way. So he has a big job. And our colleague Matt Summerfield wrote a tech piece on how Williams FW45 drew inspiration from the front runners. And if you are at the back, then that does make perfect sense. What did you think of what you saw from Williams?
Yeah, I think for them, again, it's just about trying to continue this revival, really. Like, last year was tough for them, again falling to the back of the grid. Fourth time in 5 years they finished last in the Constructors' Championship. There's been a lot of change over the winter. James Vowles coming in, as you say, Jos Capito is out. But they, I think they know that these are necessary changes. And in James Vowles, they've got an absolutely phenomenal signing. I think he's been an integral part of Mercedes' leadership throughout their domination of Formula One. So I think that he's going to be a really, really good asset. He starts on Monday as team principal. And I think that for Williams this year, yeah, they've got to look at just trying to properly get back into that midfield fight. Because last year, it was kind of like you had, okay, your big three at the front, then it was, say, McLaren, Alpine, they were sort of leading the midfield most of the time. Then there's a gaggle of teams behind. And every now and then, Williams would absolutely excel. You'd see Alex Albon in Australia or Miami, Imola as well, he put in a really good performance. And they would be able to basically get in front and just keep the cars behind. This year, they need to try and do that more regularly. It needs to be that on merit, they are there, like, not to say they weren't on merit last year, but they just needed it to be more that, like, we've actually got ourselves into the position on pure pace alone. It's not through a funky strategy or rolling the dice or anything like that. So that's the goal for them. I think that, yeah, Logan Sargeant, new driver coming in. I think that, as with any rookie, we're going to see that sort of quite steep trajectory in terms of needing to get up to speed. But Alex Albon, he's into his fourth, fifth season in F1 now. He's a very safe pair of hands. I think is in a better sort of headspace, better groove than ever, which is really, really cool to see. And I think he can really help lead Williams through this year.
And then the following day, Alfa Romeo showed off their car, which they said the C43 will be more of an all-rounder, which is interesting. We had a piece from our colleague Adam Cooper on why Audi's distant future in Formula One is helping Alfa Romeo, which was interesting. You can go check that out online. Then the car hits the track for a shakedown in Barcelona with a totally different floor. Giorgio Piola had some thoughts on that, whether it was a launch red herring or a design dead end. What did you think of what you saw from Alfa Romeo?
Yeah, it was interesting, because when they did that initial launch, a lot of people said, oh, that floor looks, yeah, very, very aggressive. And then it came to the actual shakedown itself and it wasn't there anymore. So again, it shows the difference between what you see at a launch and what you actually see on the track. There is always that a little bit of disparity. But I think for Alfa, yeah, last year, the big thing that hurt them was just the speed of upgrades, basically. They weren't quick enough and keeping up with the rest of the midfield in terms of bringing upgrades to their cars. And a lot of that is down to resources and facilities and stuff like that. And this is very much just a team that's sort of basically on the up again and recovering, I guess. So, there's a lot for them to do. They're working hard, though. I think that last year, their big benefit in the early part of the season was being pretty much the only team that had got down to the weight limit. This, and as last season wore on, that obviously became less of an advantage. This year, yeah, they've really got to focus on getting rid of the big peaks and troughs that they had. Like, you see the team go so many races without points, then all of a sudden Bottas in Mexico was like only 8 tenths off pole or something. And I asked Fred Vasseur about that sort of low period they had in the middle of the season. And he said, but if you look at the time when we were closest to pole, that was actually Mexico at the very end of the year. So it doesn't quite make sense in terms of where they were. It's a funny one. But yeah, I think they just need a bit more consistency this year. I think last year, I'm right in saying they scored the fewest points of any team between Monza until the end of the season. So there is a lot for them to try and, I think, catch up on and try to recover. So they've... the Audi Works partnership coming into force, that's going to be a massive boost for the team. Already there's kind of a nice sort of electric feel bubbling around the Alpha team, which is quite cool. It's their last season as Alpha as well before they probably go back to the Sauber name for a couple of years. So yeah, Andreas Seidlin as team boss as well, the CEO of the group, sorry. I think that's a fantastic signing, and I think that for the long term, they're in a really, really good spot, and I think I'm going to be one to watch. Maybe not this year, but in the long term future, definitely.
Yeah, I'm really interested to watch how that relationship evolves, because Audi are coming in as a full manufacturer, but for now they are an investor. They hold equity now. Their money is now going into the team, but of course they're running Ferrari bits, and of course Audi at some point will be a full competitor to Audi. So there'll be a day when the owner of the team says, can we have a look at that drawing of the engine we're buying off you? And Ferrari go, no, you can't. But of course, the answer is yes, because we're a customer. So they'll be learning an amount. And it's going to be, you know, how much of that will be relevant to Audi's program. It's politically really interesting, I think, anyway. So we'll see how that goes. It was a bit of a low-key AlphaTauri launch. Not necessarily for them, because they were in New York, but I'm saying for many of the European time zone followers. I think it was 11 p.m. UK, midnight Central European livery launch in New York. Then we saw some renders of the AT04. They called it a strong evolution. Then I think they had a shakedown at Misano, but I've not seen the pictures from that. So just a quick word on AlphaTauri and what you thought of that.
Yeah, as you say, it was quite a low-key launch, to be honest. I was with some friends. I didn't cover the launch itself. I had a half marathon the next day, so I was just watching it with some friends who were covering it, other journalists. And it was about 2 minutes, the whole sort of like unveiling video on YouTube. It was quite short and sweet. But like their drivers this year, Nyck de Vries and Yuki Tsunoda, probably the shortest F1 driver lineup in the history of the sport, I would go as far as saying. But I think, again, with AlphaTauri, it's they just need to try and like make this step forward again. And every year we hear about this target of breaking to the top five and everything. And last year was a pretty tough season for them. I think they got some things wrong in terms of their wind tunnel sort of plans and stuff in the development of the car. So I think they've probably learned a lot from that. I think for this year, they're getting used to using the bigger 60% wind tunnel now as well. So that's always going to work in their favor, I think. But the driver lineup, Yuki Tsunoda, his third season, he needs to step up. He needs to, I think, really be the team leader there. And then in Nyck de Vries, I think they've got a fantastic driver. I think he's shown what he can do in F2 and Formula E and sports cars, and now he's finally got his chance in F1. So I think he's going to be on it from very, very early days. But again, one of those launches where you're kind of left with probably more questions than answers, but maybe that's how teams want it to be, to keep us guessing until the opening race.
We're halfway, and then we get into this week. Frantic, really. McLaren, Aston, Ferrari, Mercedes, Alpine. First of all, we shipped you up to Woking, and you saw McLaren, who revealed they weren't entirely happy with the launch spec car. This year, McLaren said they might be building, despite the Red Bull hints that were seen on the car, wrote our colleague Jake Boxall-Legg. Why Piastri being constantly a little bit unhappy was seen as a positive. And I guess you can turn that around, because he just wants to improve. And but he wasn't over the moon. Norris was, I would say, you know, within himself. He wasn't, you know, exuberant at the launch, but he was happy to wait a few more years for McLaren to come good. So yeah, a few design clues from Red Bull on the McLaren. They've definitely got a long-term focus. But you were there. So what was that launch like, and what do you think of the car that they unveiled?
Yeah, it's definitely about the long-term. And Lando Norris, he said throughout all his answers that he's really thinking he's got to be patient. He knows that he's not going to be fighting for race wins or championships with McLaren this year or maybe next year, but they're getting things in place now. Like they're cash flow positive now, which is something that McLaren wasn't for a while. They can now look at things like, yeah, their wind tunnel is going to be online in 2024, and I think the 2025 car is going to be the first one that really feels the full benefit of all of the steps that McLaren has been putting in place to improve its facilities and everything like that. So I think that it's gonna come in time, but it's just about how long you're willing to sort of bide your time and be patient for, like, someone like Lando Norris. Oscar Piastri, a fantastic young driver, they've obviously done well to get their man, so I think that's gonna be exciting to see how he gets on. His Genius EV is phenomenal, it really, really is. But I think that it was interesting Andrea Stella saying they weren't entirely happy with how the car was, and I think it's maybe downplaying expectations a little bit, and it's not always the most encouraging sign going into a new season. I think particularly when you see how close that midfield is, how tight the fight was with Alpine last year for P4, the fact that Aston Martin are on the rise as well, I think it's a real interesting season ahead for McLaren. I think that sort of fourth, fifth, sixth battle is going to be really, really close. But yeah, the early sort of noises at McLaren maybe haven't been the most positive, but ultimately we'll only know once they get on track and whether they can maybe improve a bit of the development slope that they last year fell a little bit behind on compared to Alpine in particular.
Okay, well, we'll watch them. And then we shipped you up from Woking to Silverstone to see the launch of Aston Martin. Aggressive was the word they used a lot in terms of their car design. Fernando Alonso told you he expects difficult races to start the year. And then we got some news after the event as well that longtime tech boss had been moved on. Andy Green moving away from the racing side. He's not been moved out of the company, just a change of roles by the look of it. But just, I think they're, you know, finessing how they go racing at the weekends with some new people coming into the team as well. What were your thoughts on what you saw and the task ahead of Aston Martin?
Pretty positive launch, I must say. I think that with Aston Martin, Lawrence Stroll is putting everything behind this. He really, really is. And he said on stage, he said, when I get excited about something, I'm passionate about something. When I'm passionate about something, I win. And he was very, very clear that he's doing this to win. He's not doing this to make up the numbers. He wants to build, in his words, one of the great Formula One teams. They're building a new $200 million state-of-the-art factory. It's very, very impressive. They did the launch from the inside of there. It's still not fully built, but it's going to be, yeah, a very, very, very cool structure and factory once it's finished. And then Fernando Alonso, the big name signing, the big bombshell of the driver market last year, him going there, he made clear that this year is really all about setting a good baseline for the future. And he said that if I'm not here in 5 years' time, but Aston Martin is fighting for race wins and championships, then I'll be proud that I've played a part in that. And he said that he's very demanding. He wants 100% from everyone around him. And Aston Martin said that actually they really like that. They want that. And I think that's what they need right now. They need someone like Alonso to come in and say to them, look, this is wrong, this is right, we need to do this better. And I think he can be a really, really good asset for them and help their development forward. But the sort of whispers about Aston Martin, they've been pretty positive for this year, I must say. I think it's exciting to see the direction they've gone in with that car. And I think that, yeah, if we look at what they might be able to achieve this year, they're not going to be fighting for race wins and championships this year, we know that. But Alonso said that it's about getting a good baseline for the future. And I think that this could really be the first year we see Aston Martin under its new sort of guise and brand take a big step forward, and not necessarily to the top three, but get in that front of the midfield fight.
Well, there are still two more teams in the top three we haven't talked about. Let's get on to that. It was a brilliant launch. I loved it so much for Ferrari because they put the car on track. They did it at Fiorano near Maranello, and they built a grandstand for the fans who were chanting the names of the drivers. The drivers were in their race suits. The engineers were there firing up the car. And that, you know, when you get oily bits involved at a car launch, it's always good. I spoke to our colleague Roberto Quincaro for the podcast and the YouTube video of that. He said that they will be making adjustments. New boss Frederic Vasseur making adjustments to the F1 strategy process on the pit wall, but no one's losing their job overnight. The big thing that was noticed was the front wing and a design that Mercedes chose not to run last year in Austin, but a cleverly shaped front wing with slot gap separators coming back because of a change of the rules announced last December, where a sentence was removed really about what those can do, and some big suspension changes as well. Ferrari focused on the car balance weaknesses with the SF23 car. Sainz said that Ferrari were brave to run the car at a public launch event. And even though these are evolutions on last year's car, yes, Ferrari know how to build an engine. Hopefully it wouldn't break down halfway through. Even some rumours I heard that the Mercedes shakedown, the first installation lap they did, they just had to slow it down, bring it back and just fix a quick thing. Like that, it would have been embarrassing if the car had gone up in smoke. It didn't. It was brilliant. What did you make of the Ferrari that you saw? A really bold, I think, aero package that they put on it for a launch car. And it was running as well. So what did you make of that?
It was very impressive, yeah. And as you say, very bold to just say, look, we're going to get out there and do the shakedown pretty much in front of the watching world, in front of the cameras, in front of the fans, and for it to go so smoothly. For me, I loved that the launch just encapsulated everything that makes Ferrari so special and unique in Formula One. It was the Tifosi fans at the absolute heart of everything they did. It was wonderful to see them cheering for Leclerc and Carlos Sainz. Sainz even mentioned antipasti at one point, and the crowd went absolutely wild for the idea of dipping bread in oil, which I absolutely loved. But it was great that I think Ferrari, yeah, they came out of the blocks really, really strongly. And again, there was sort of a feeling of quiet confidence, I think, about everything they did. That they were able to say, look, we're going to put this car on track for you all to see, run it straight away. And that was really, really cool. So, I think Ferrari can be really, really pleased with everything they did. We're only going to see, I think, come the opening race, just what these small adjustments that Fred Vasseur has talked about on the sort of strategy team and the processes, what they actually entail and what does actually change for this year. But I think that, yeah, for Ferrari this year, they just got to learn from last year. They've got to take that fight properly to Red Bull this season. I think they're the team probably in the strongest shape to actually do that following this sort of winter period. We'll see in testing how things stack up, but they've got the drivers. I think they've got the right team boss. I think they had a good team boss anyway, but I think Fred Vasseur could be really, really good for them as well. And I think now it's just about putting all the puzzle pieces together to mount a sustained title challenge throughout the season and get on top of the reliability issues that blighted the engine last year, the tyre management issues, and probably mount a serious charge for the championship.
Yeah, what's this story about the engine on the dyno proving that it's more reliable, has nailed those gremlins? Because they had to turn the combustion bit down from, it's been Mexico was particularly affected as well last year and towards the end of the season. So what's the story there?
Yeah, it's just that they couldn't run the engine in full power, basically, which is obviously a rather major issue to have when you're trying to probably take the fight to Red Bull. And that meant they sort of overcompensated in terms of the drivers pushing a bit too hard, and that led to the tyre management issues. And so it's all kind of a knock-on effect, really. But the Ferrari say that they've done some good running on the dyno. They've got rid of those gremlins. All the power units are frozen for performance, but you are allowed to make reliability changes. So that's why they've been able to make those tweaks for this year. And they're seemingly quite confident about what position they've got that engine into. So I think it'd be important for Ferrari, if they can, again, just have the car able to run full power, not worry about the tyres so much, and they'll be in much better shape.
And there's also restrictions on software coming in now as well as engine development. But again, the teams can change it based on reliability. And this is where some of the friction comes up as well, where a team will make an improvement and go, well, it was because of reliability, but they've also got performance gains through that. But that's a legitimate fix, right? So teams can still work on things.
Yeah, they can. Yeah, again, so long as it's reliability, then that's fine. And ultimately, if by improving the engine reliability, you can run it at full power, that gives you therefore more performance, that's fine. That's not directly impacting the actual performance of a power unit. So there's little things they can do, basically. But I think for Ferrari, they're gonna be hopefully in good shape to give a proper, hopefully a three-team title fight going into the new season.
Well, let's get onto that. Mercedes unveiled their W14 back in black for various reasons. Toto Wolff said on stage that it was a weight saving and also going back to the heritage of stripping the paint off of the silver arrows. But also there is, from Lewis Hamilton's very high profile campaign around inclusivity, that aspect of it as well. But Toto mainly attributed to weight saving. They haven't thrown away their concept for the old car. In fact, the overhead shots at the launch reminded me how skinny that car is. Some changes to the floor as well. And Mercedes say they've got some side pod revamps coming. There's a Jonathan Noble article, which we put out a couple of days ago, that they'll be bringing some upgrades pretty early on in the season. And a lot of talk was about the livery, but what did we see underneath that? What was interesting about that car?
Yeah, I think there were some notable changes on the car already, particularly around the engine and gully area. I think that was quite interesting, the direction they've gone in. But the big thing was, yeah, that they've kept that zero pod side pod concept we saw last year that I think everyone expected to be changing. And we know that, yeah, there may be some tweaks to come, as you said, from John's article in the opening few races. But they, it was interesting that kind of core DNA that I think everyone expected to be completely done away with, and the suggestions from Mercedes were they were going to go down a different direction, are still there. And they explained it saying they wanted to keep the good bits of the W13. It wasn't all bad, the car. But Lewis Hamilton, he said that basically, there was a lot that needed to change from the back to the very front of the car. So it's an interesting situation for Mercedes. I think that they know last year was, I think, a very sobering season. It was a very tough season for them. And I think this year they really do need to strike back and make a big step forward so they can get back in that title fight. The trajectory they went on towards the back end of last year was very encouraging, for definite. But over the winter, yeah, Ferrari and Red Bull, they won't have been sleeping. So it's going to definitely be, I think, big challenge for Mercedes to keep up and to be able to sort of bridge that gap. But they know how to do it. They've won championships. They're a very slick operation. So I think if anyone is capable of that, it is Mercedes. But it was very interesting that whereas last year was quite bullish, the sort of mood from like Lewis Hamilton, particularly after the Abu Dhabi fiasco, saying that, yeah, I want to come back stronger, and they were going all out. This year he said that, yeah, he said we're being cautious, a bit cautiously optimistic about our chances, and it was maybe a little bit more understated than that's been in previous years from Mercedes.
Yeah, Autosport asked George Russell about, you know, you're bringing side pod revisions already early on in the season, which was spun initially as a positive piece of news, but if you're doing that already, how confident really are you in your concept and are the wind tunnel numbers coming through? And, you know, he didn't just brush it away. He said, you know, it's a long season and we've got time to recover if we don't start strong. So a bit like McLaren, everyone seems to be tempering expectations, but if at this stage the drivers are already saying, well, you know, there's gaps between races which allow us to bring upgrades, goodness me, for Mercedes fans, that doesn't sound good. How do you feel about that?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because is it smoke and mirrors? Do you want to be sort of like keeping your cars close to your chest? How do you want to play it? So it is very, very tricky. But I think for Mercedes, yeah, the mood is, it does feel a little bit different to how it's been in previous years. But again, we've not seen Mercedes in this situation really before for a very long time, because they've been always the front running team. They've always been one of the two quickest teams. Last year they were firmly third quickest, and now they're in this position, well, okay, but how do we fight back? Like, how do we actually get back into proper contention? I think that's why, yeah, there's probably been a bit of caution just about how they're going about things so far over this winter. We're only going to know for sure, obviously, at that opening race. But even from the shakedown and stuff like that, it's there's not been sort of like a big statement out of what they're doing. But maybe that's for good reason. Maybe it's because they want to keep everything so close to their chest. So let's see until testing and the opening race where Mercedes actually is. But it's definitely been a case of managing expectations so far, I think.
Last night was Alpine. It's the most recent, so people probably got that on their mind already. We saw two cars, a pink one, which wasn't the car, and the Alpine blue, which was last year's car, probably bits of this car, maybe. But again, it was more of a show, it felt like a corporate commercial thing last night, talking about the Race Her program, which is amazing, young women in motorsport and girls in karting, and actually, you know, some good stuff on the stage as well with the cars. But I guess we'll find out more when it hits the track, which it already kind of did do earlier this week. So there's those spice shots. What do you think of Alpine very quickly?
Yeah, they said they did a really good shakedown. They admitted that last year Lauren Rossi said in Abu Dhabi they were a shambles in pre-season, and Esteban Ocon said last night that they feel so much more race ready this year than they did last year. He said the car is so much more developed, it seems so much of a step forward. So I think it was a pretty upbeat mood from Alpine. They've got obviously Ocon and Pierre Gasly now as their driver lineup. There was the inevitable question about, oh, like, you guys, are you going to get on? And Gasly, I won't say exactly what he said back because I can't, but he it was words to the effects of, I've not seen you for 3 months, and that's the first question you asked me, really? And it was quite funny. But they're in a good a good spot, I think. Again, they had their engine reliability issues last year. The water pump was very problematic for them. They've done a lot of work to fix that. Again, they're pretty confident about the running on the dyno that they've done. They've got, I think, a really exciting driver lineup. Two very good drivers there with Ocon and Gasly. I think it'll be very well balanced. And yeah, I think that for Alpine, it was an evening where a lot of it was about, as you said, the Racer program, which is fantastic. It was about Zinedine Zidane becoming their new ambassador. But underneath all of that, I think that really the car does sound, it does sound like they're in a good point, particularly compared to this time last year. So I think if they can start the season stronger, that'll put them in a really good spot when it comes to that fight to be topping the midfield.
Well, that's our look back at launch season. We haven't got to wait now long until Bahrain testing is here. You'll be jumping on a plane, and sadly, we won't be hearing from you on this podcast. But fans of What You Do will still be able to follow you. I can say no more. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast today. Remind anyone who's listening that doesn't follow how people can follow you personally on your socials.
Yeah, I'm at LukeSmithF1 on pretty much everything. Your Twitters, your Instagram, I even do TikTok now. I don't do it very well or very frequently, but yeah, that's where you can keep up with me. And I guess just finally to just say again, thank you ever so much to everybody, to everyone at Autosport. You've all been absolutely amazing friends and colleagues, and I'm gonna miss you all so much. To all the podcast listeners, thank you so much for listening to my thoughts and ramblings over the past 3 years. And I'm really excited for the next chapter. I'm gonna keep bringing people fantastic coverage from the paddock. I hope it's still fantastic coverage, obviously, but I'm gonna be there. It's it's gonna be a different set of colors for me, so to speak, but I'm excited for it. But Autosport has said it's unmatched by anything else in motorsport media, and I'm just so excited to see what all of you guys go on to do. And we're still going to be seeing lots of each other, I know. Our paths are going to keep crossing, so I'm really excited to see what's next for Autosport. But from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much.
I've got to go. Very sad, but also very happy. Luke, thank you so much. That is your podcast for today. You can get in contact with us via social media. You can email me as well if you want to. We have podcast@autosport.com with your thoughts on the season. I read your emails, your questions for our team as well if you want to. That's podcast@autosport.com. Have a good one, and we'll see you on the next one.
Podcast Network.